You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
All right, Model Railcasters. Finally, show 218, and we were reunited with John Gardner, the fourth G4s, we like to call him. He was with the show a while back, actually did some work for Ryan Anderson, so it was really good to get back with him. He's now 20 years old, if any of you remember him back when he was in his teens doing work for the Model Railcast show. A very highly educated guy, and we were honored to have him with us. And basically what follows is we're going to interview him, and actually he put together a wonderful bunch of notes and really has some great anecdotal advice here that a lot of which he experienced firsthand. And I will tell you right away, he is not saying this is authoritative advice, but it's definitely valid, definitely worth paying attention to. And a lot of it me and Craig can definitely attest to, these being valuable lessons, especially for someone who might just be getting in the hobby. This show, this particular show, the Model Railcast show, might just be for you, the beginner. But we, even us seasoned model railroaders, can still learn a thing or two. And so I hope you enjoy show 218. And without further ado, I will just go right on into that.
Three, two, one.
Come across well. So why don't we just roll right on into this thing?
Alrighty then.
All right.
So I have this interview slash script divvied up into a few parts, and the first one is what happened to John, because of course I am narcissistic and cannot give you any information without first tooting my own horn.
It must be done. It must be done. So.
So first off, I actually acquired the nickname G4.
I heard that on the pod. That is a sweet nickname. I'm just saying.
Why, thank you very much, Sir Harrison. The nickname G4 comes from John Houston Gardiner the Fourth, mm-hmm. Gardiner IV, G4, and my father's G3, and my son will be G5, and so on.
Very good, very good.
My grandson will have like a G6 to back him up.
Nice.
If you've ever heard that song.
I believe I have, actually. I like what you're doing with this, I do.
Why, thank you again, Sir Harrison.
So
as I already covered in brief a few moments ago, right at the very end of when I was moving from Utah to Washington State, and I think just after I moved here, I had about 3 additional seasons worth of footage for a Model Railcast video that was given a 9-episode season. So that's what, something like 27 different episodes. And I had them about 2/3 edited and was getting ready to release them. But then all of a sudden, my computer crashed for a variety of reasons.
Oh.
I went in and out of the Apple store 9 times in 2 months. And at the very end, they just gave me a brand new computer and said, go away.
Which is, I mean, you got a new computer, but all that work, oh my gosh.
I think I actually have it all saved somewhere on a backup drive, but in looking back at some of it, I can do better. I've gotten older and wiser by, okay, not much, but you get my point.
I totally understand, my man.
So months before I left Utah, I tried to build a small micro layout, a 5-level wall-mounted layout with an elevator that was meant to be framed and looked like a giant picture, kind of based on Carl Arend's work, if you've ever read the small layout scrapbook. I was a little bit too grandiose in my predictions, and it never moved beyond bench work, so I think I could have and should have done better, but that was one thing that I tried to do with model railroading. But then I moved here to Seattle, taking the 3x9-foot layout with me, and I transferred to the University of Washington in Seattle, one of the 4 best universities in the world for a scientific education.
Nice.
At the moment that I moved here, I immediately started construction on a model of the Simpson Timber Company, which was meant to fill an entire room that I have here in the basement, but I kind of bit off way more than I can chew, and I didn't even get half of the bench work built, much less the sub-road bed. So for about 2 years, I kind of sputtered out of the train realm very sadly, much to my dismay. You know how everybody says that model railroaders usually suffer from the fumes, the perfumes and the gas fumes?
Yes, yes, I do believe.
In my case, it was a little bit more of the fumes of Neuron Flambé. From all of the studying.
Oh, you just used some words there. I'm not sure we understand.
Yeah, in short, my brain was fried. So in the intervening time, some less relevant train stuff, but it kind of actually all plays back together later. I, against all odds, I have no idea how this happened, I got a beautiful and fantastic girlfriend who originally lived 70 miles south of me in Olympia, Washington, which is the state capital. That fact comes in importance later. I took a trip to London for 17 days with my family. Then I completed my degree in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology with departmental honors and the President's Club, so at least giving up trains got me something worthwhile.
Yeah, right, man.
And then I started work at a small, very small, as in 3 people, myself included, research company in South Lake Union, which is kind of a biotech hub in Seattle.
Very cool. Wow. So a little bit busy then, a little bit busy.
Yeah, more or less. So during those 2 years or so when I was doing nothing but homework and dying emotionally, I kept saying all I wanted was just one opportunity to run one of my trains in a circle.
Right.
And I kept saying that, and yet miraculously I never actually did anything with it. Then my hobby interest kind of restarted a little bit. I became an avid transit rider because the Seattle traffic is so horrendous.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I discovered the city's beautiful light rail and the South Lake Union streetcar. Actually, on a slight aside, when they were first building the South Lake Union streetcar, some not-so-intelligent government official decided to call it the South Lake Union trolley.
Oh.
What is that abbreviated?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So all of the Amazon and biotech employees in South Lake Union now talk very avidly and openly about riding the slut multiple times a day.
I'm going to have to tell my wife that one.
Oh, no kidding. In fact, they even sell t-shirts. Mind you, the streetcar line was opened, what, 5 or 7 years ago, and they're still selling t-shirts?
Wow.
Yeah, so anyway, but the light rail, I've done a lot of research on the light rail, and it's actually one of the fastest rush hour transportation networks in the world, okay. Reaching an average speed of over 30 miles an hour.
Okay.
Honestly, I've looked at a lot of light rail lines around America, and in my opinion, they all fall under one of 2 categories, the hypersonic shoebox or the mid-century modern flying blob.
Right.
However, Seattle strikes the fantastic mid-range between those two, and the light rail looks beautiful. Honestly, if you're listening, if you are a part of any sort of transportation network, look at Seattle and buy our light rail vehicles before you look at anywhere else.
Yeah, you know, that on the Millville line, which is what I model here, they've been talking for years about restoring passenger service to it, and they've been thinking basically like a light rail type solution for that. There's still heavy rail there. It's still a very busy freight line, but possibly maybe even either putting in some more sidings or putting in a light rail line beside it. They're not sure what they want to do yet, but they've been looking at stuff like that. And we have the river line here in Jersey, which is all light rail. But I'm going to have to take a look at these Seattle job here. And if it looks really cool, which from what you're saying, it sounds like it, man, we should start writing to our congressman and whatnot here saying, this is what you need to do.
Oh, no kidding. Actually, with respect to the Seattle Light Rail, it just opened up two new stations, one of them to Capitol Hill, which is the world famous gay district in Seattle, LGBTQ, et cetera.
Okay.
And then one more, it opened up to the University of Washington. Of course, it had to open to the University of Washington 9 months after I stopped going.
Oh, figures.
Grumble, grumble, grumble.
Yeah.
But that happened, it's what, May 16th right now? It happened about 1 month and 29 days ago, and it has already set ridership records. Those two stations alone brought in over 77,000 people on one weekend specifically. It is... If we divorce it from Sound Transit, its operator, it's still the fourth largest transit agency in the state. One single 19-mile stretch of rail. No branches.
Wow. That's pretty dang cool.
77,000 people a day. I mean, that's more than a small city.
Yeah, that's astronomic right there in terms of ridership.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Rocky start building it in the early 2000s. It opened in 2009, but now everybody has in Seattle what we're calling light rail fever.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit of an aside, but you get the idea.
Yeah, for sure.
So I became a transit nut. The trip to England that I mentioned earlier, it being England and Europe, of course, involved copious tube and passenger rail trips, which kind of got me on the ground with railroads again, and that really helped to reignite some of the train bugs that I had previously. On one trip specifically that we had to Windsor Castle, we took like an hour one-way train trip. It's Windsor Castle is a place where the Queen of England or the Windsor family have a large castle somewhere west of downtown of the main London area. So we took a train out there and got to tour the castle, it obviously being beautiful. But when we were picking up the train in Waterloo Station, I was marching around a small shop, a small newsstand, trying to grab snacks and munchies for the trip. And then all of a sudden, what do you know? I see a Model Railroad magazine. Obviously, it's British, though. So well, I decided I picked it up, decided to buy it, and I read it all the way to Windsor and all the way back, and I was drooling uncontrollably the whole time.
It reignited the spark.
No kidding. Big time. However, when I returned home, for some reason, and this was my biggest mistake, I perpetually thought that because I had completed successfully the small switching layout, my only next possible step was a small to medium room-filling layout. And so I kept grumbling to myself, oh, I wish I had time to build a layout that filled a room. Oh, I wish I could build a layout that filled a room. I wish I had the money, so on and so forth. And I just stalled there. I really am embarrassed about that because one day while I was walking down the Montlake Cut drawbridge one early morning on my way to classes, I was talking to Kit and I literally had an epiphany, as in I was struck with a bolt of lightning containing the best inspiration in my entire life. And my script says, in Aristotle Eureka voice, instead of waiting to build a room-filling layout, I can build another better small layout.
That is so important, that revelation right there.
Exactly. I am truly humiliated that I did not think of it before. And so, with that, every single spare second I had from late January, I think it was 2015, until spring break, I spent my time digging through my old track plans to look for small layout inspiration.
Fair.
And I'll get back to that later to describe to you what I'm building right now and how I came to build it. But even though I was back into model railroading, I just couldn't use my old layout, and I had to start anew for some of the following reasons. Now, this is the lessons learned from the old layout portion of the interview, which is less narcissistic than previously. So these were all really hard-fought lessons that I learned with the old layout, and I had a lot of trouble with it. I'll get to all of the things, all the specific reasons why, but I just assumed that having such a terrible struggle was part of the hobby, and so I kept gritting my teeth and not doing much about it. But having a new layout that actually functions properly, I can't believe I didn't do this earlier and rip up everything before. So, starting with the vast list of mistakes I made is the track work. My track was plagued with kinks at track joints, both lateral and vertical. The tight curves on the layout of 18 inches radii or less were eyeballed, leading to a very uneven curve that certainly didn't look well or function well. And then I had really huge lengths of ties that were removed for feeder wires, but never filled back in, and it looked really bad and unprofessional.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. On the bench work, I chickened out and used the Woodland Scenics foam layout modules. I mean, they're good products, but it didn't work so well for me. At the time that I started building this layout, I think I was, 13 years old? So I really was terrified of power tools and terrified of asking for advice. So I really regretted the mistake that I made of going with the easy-to-build foam layouts. Honestly, if I had to give anybody advice, it would be grit your teeth and pick up the power tools to build something solid.
Right.
The modules survived time and age very well, but their faults kind of lie in construction. Part of it was me just being a sloppy youngling. The modules didn't have very well built interfaces from joint to joint. The foam butt joints without reinforcement weren't very good. It's not like I had any overlapping reinforcements. They were also really large and bulky, I mean, 3 by 3 feet without adequate handholds, even though each module was very lightweight.
Right.
And could, in theory, be hauled around by only one person. The fact that they were so large without any handles or handholds meant that they were very difficult to move around, and I dinged them up a lot that way. The foam itself is obviously subject to much more damage than wood. And also, something that you might not anticipate, it just didn't look very professional.
Yeah, you know, I didn't anticipate that, but, like, you flesh that out a little bit. Like, what do you think was throwing it off the most in the look?
Part of the Woodland Scenics method for building the layout was that you would have foam sides, and then you would fill in those foam sides with crumpled up newspaper balls.
Okay.
And then in order to make the scenery and reinforce the modules, you would take typical plaster cloth and you would lay them over the crumpled up newspaper, but then you would take that plaster cloth down the side of the module too. And in theory, I could have covered it with something like Masonite, but the fact that it was left untouched and white, just rough plaster cloth and bright white, it really didn't look very professional.
Right. No, I gotcha. Very good. Okay.
So, anyway, next were the electrical issues. I made the mistake of using DCC unfriendly turnouts, which unfortunately had a lot of contact-based electrical bridges at the point rails.
Okay.
When I later balanced the track, I was once again very sloppy, and I accidentally got a lot of spare mat medium onto all of these contact-based electrical bridges, which dramatically reduced the connectivity across turnouts.
Okay.
This made some sidings as good as unusable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, actually, if you go back into my YouTube videos, I should have a video of outtakes. And if you watch that, a vast majority of the outtakes are of my wonderful little 060 workhorse locomotive attempting to go across a turnout and stalling the moment it hits the point rails because they're dead.
Yeah, that's. I have a few of those outtakes too, but yeah.
But I had sometimes 40 in a day of filming
for my
podcast video. And I would just do one point over and over again until miraculously the train would go across for some reason. It really was not good at all for operations. This was compounded by the fact that my feeders were far too infrequent. And then, of course, my frogs were unpowered. So even on a good turnout, on a good day, my little short wheelbase 060 locomotive would run across the frog, and if it was going below a minimum speed, it would just stall again.
Okay, yeah.
So those are some pretty big and glaring issues that I had. Probably, though, not as bad as the grades. So
yeah, I saw that coming on the scripts. Yeah, so the listeners don't have the luxury of having the script, but I do.
Yeah, actually, no, it's probably a good thing that they don't have the script, because looking at the page count, it's 15 pages and almost 4,000 words, so we're probably doing them a benefit. I tend to get carried away when I do
that's okay. I understand completely.
Yeah. So the grades themselves, I used a rudimentary math when I was 13 to try and get the track up as high as possible to make it look more like a mountainside and to better visually separate the scenes. So all of the grades were using the Woodland Scenic's 4% foam bridges, if you guys
yes.
know them.
Yes.
And those actually worked very well, and I would kind of recommend them for other people, except for two things. The first one is that, and I imagine that this is worse on the steeper grades, but the grades themselves ended and began rather abruptly from block to block. If you had any flat portions, and I didn't have the foresight to foresee that that was a problem. And that led to a lot of vertical kinks. But the worst part was as I was building the layout, I discovered that I positioned a turnout incorrectly, but I wanted to keep it where it was. So I took one of the foam inclines and I squished it together laterally so that it was shorter and went up feet. When I was writing this script, I was curious to see what that final gradient actually was like. So I grabbed myself a ruler, and I went back into the train room, did the math, and almost had a heart attack. The grade was almost 22%. No wonder locomotives couldn't make it up very easily. Some of them actually could. Specifically, I think it was the Bachmann Climax.
Okay.
But my Shay was having a lot of gearing problems with the old Bachmann drive where the plastic would wear out. And then, well, the 060 tank engine is a literal featherweight, and so it didn't make it very well either. Honestly, I really should have done the math during construction, and I should have invested in something other than the foam inclines. So, and actually the worst thing, I can send you a picture if you want to include it with the show notes. The monster 22% grade was also on a very sharp S-curve. And so when I got my 282 Mikado locomotive, it would derail at both segments of the S-curve because it was so wobbly and so tight of a curve and on a grade. Yeah, they would just literally rock off the track.
So it was a rotary dumper then.
No kidding. Yeah, so no, don't do that.
This is how we learn, John.
No kidding. $1,000 lesson I just bought myself there. Anyway, also, another thing that I didn't foresee was the fact that I didn't build a yard on the layout. I did originally build it with the intention of just making it a small switching layout and then maybe adding a yard later when I expanded it. But in 2011, I decided to build a staging yard in lieu of a proper expansion, and I built it out of sectional track and a turntable that I had left over from my previous layout. This portion of the railroad actually worked out very, very well with, you know, good electrical connectivity, and honestly was probably the best thing that ever happened to the switching layout. In reality, I actually ran more trains on the staging yard than I did the layout itself,
okay.
In part because of the above electrical issues, but also because since it was nothing but a roundabout and a few spurs that were very widely separated from each other, I couldn't do anything in the way of car sorting.
Okay.
So I learned that, and this is actually probably a very important thing that we should spread to beginners, I learned that yards are just as important for model railroading purposes as they are operations.
Amen.
Because it gives you a place to store cars and trains that are not in use. It gives you a place to make up trains and to fiddle around with things however you want.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so many times we get caught into thinking that it's just like a kind of a cosmetic thing, or we're putting it there because we want it to look like a real railroad. But no, you're absolutely spot on. I mean, it serves a true function on our model railroads just as much as it does the prototype. So
exactly. I mean, there's a reason why they existed on the real railroads.
Exactly. So I'm sorry. Please continue.
Oh, no. It's okay. It's perfectly fine for you to interrupt. In fact, that's probably a good thing. I mean, you have just as much excuse me, let's be honest. You have more experience than I do.
I did have a long hiatus, though, so I think we're pretty close there.
Who knows? So, honestly, because of that, I really did regret not having at least a small yard on my railroad proper. So, also, the structures, well, they were kind of an amateurish attempt at a craftsman structure kit. And they weren't necessarily built to the highest degree of verisimilitude that I could have accomplished. The kits were almost entirely unpainted, unweathered. They were just bare wood. And more importantly, they were a little bit shoddily built, and there were many gaps left between boards, and I didn't do that properly at all. I mean, they looked fine for the purpose of modeling, but if I had attempted anything with any other sort of craftsman structure kit, like with what Scotty Mason produces and whatnot, it would have looked very bad. I didn't put as much time into those kits as I should have. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I really didn't anticipate, when I moved to Seattle, probably one of the biggest factors that got me out of the hobby was my original workbench had been lost in the move to Seattle. So, interestingly, not having any place to work was actually a major thing that prevented me from getting anything done, and also contributed to me temporarily losing interest in the hobby. So that's another thing that I highly advise beginners, is to get some sort of old table, no matter how small, and to reserve it exclusively as a workspace, not a storage space, but a place that you can work upon.
Yes, that is huge. You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because if on this show, and I know you've heard it too, if we received any one piece of advice from seasoned model railroaders, that is, they just say, just build something. I don't care how small it is, just build something so that you can get something on it. And because if you don't, yeah, basically it just sort of kills that inspiration. So, yeah, I'm in total agreement with that.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing that I would like to add on building a workbench or having a workbench is that, interestingly, I built my own while I was building the benchwork for this layout. I had a bunch of spare lumber from the ill-fated Simpson Timber Company, and so I put it together and I built myself a very sturdy benchwork, just completely from scratch, and it was actually surprisingly easy, especially because I was already doing the railroad benchwork itself. All of the tools were already there. It was just more of a few extra cuts, a few extra bolts, a little bit of extra plywood, and there you go. The best thing about it was I took a page from the, I was about to say book of, but probably better, magazine of Model Railroader, and I put it on casters, both the layout and the workbench. And so that makes my layout room a lot more flexible.
Gotcha. Very nice. Okay.
I mean, the casters themselves, the big sturdy ones that I got, they're like $6 or $9 at Home Depot. And then it's, what, times 4 for the bench work, plus 4 for the layout, and I have never had any single more useful invention or use in the hobby of anything before, except for this.
Very nice. Makes a ton of... The casters love that idea, because sooner or later you're really going to need to move it anyway, so great, great.
Exactly. Oh, Drat, I'm getting to the part in my script that's entitled Worst Mistakes of All.
Oh, goodness. And again, yeah, no, I hear you, but this is, I think, I'm so convinced that so oftentimes we learn more from hearing about other people's mistakes. If anything, it helps us realize, hey, we're not alone, and this guy made that same mistake I did, so I'm not in bad company at all. So with that in mind, please enlighten us.
Yeah, if you're listening to the show right now, please don't do what I'm about to describe. Just don't. So with all of the previous bad track work that I had, I tried to fix my railroad equipment that disliked the track work instead of the track work itself. And this kind of came to a head when I got myself some 80-foot Pullmans. Those things could not go more than 12 inches on the layout without some sort of derailment, and I kept fiddling with them and playing with their wheel sets and couplers and everything instead of the track work. Also, and this was probably the single biggest mistake that I had in the entire, that I've ever made in the entire hobby, at the hobby shop, I picked up a small gel or liquid that was supposed to be an electrically conducting material that you could spread on the wheels of your locomotives, and it would help with the electrical conductivity all around the layout. I relied on that way too much more than I should have, and there were times when the rails were so slick the locomotives couldn't move up a moderate grade, much less the 22% nightmare. Because I was using it so much. Before I would turn on the layout, I would take this bottle and I would liberally dose all of the problematic points with it instead of actually fixing the points themselves. Mm. So these were two of many ramshackle, and I quote unquote here, fixes that only made the railroad more difficult to deal with in the long run. Unfortunately for me, I never once tried to fix the source of the problem, which was the track work. And this was in part due to the fact that I really couldn't, because using the foam sub-roadbed and putting it up in the way that I had meant that I would have to, in order to fix the track, I would have to rip up not only all of the track, but also all of the sub-roadbed and all of the scenery too. Because if I were to rip up all of the track and lower it a few inches at its highest point, like I should have in order to do things properly, it would be in a literal gully inside where it used to be, and I would have to bring all the scenery down to match it. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, with that, do you want to bring Craig on?
Is that him?
Yeah.
Yardlessness. Is that a word?
Well, it is now.
It is now.
Okay, got it.
I saw John's degrees there. Yeah, it's okay. A word.
There you are. All right, I'm right with you. Go ahead.
All right. So now we're getting to, or now that you have heard all of the horror stories from my previous experiences, I've distilled this down into an amalgamation of lessons learned that I would like to lessons learned that I would like to share with other modelers, so that you don't make the same horrible mistakes that I have.
First, how bad could it be?
Well, let's just wait for you to listen to the first half of the episode, Craig, and you'll see how bad it can be.
Very well, yes. I apologize to everybody. I did unfortunately have an appointment tonight, and I'm here a little bit late, but, you know, better late than never, as they say.
Absolutely.
All right, so to bench work. Bench work is the foundation of everything. Do it right. Do not build any bench work without a plan clearly labeled with measurements, angles, wood dimensions, and accurate to 1/4 inch.
Okay.
Do not do anything less. Oh, well, conversely, do not do anything more. 1x3s are generally sufficient. The 2x4s that I used for the ill-fated Simpson Railroad turned out to be more battleship hulls than model railroad benchwork.
Okay.
Also, build all of your benchwork so that it can be easily disassembled in modules, even if the layout is meant to be permanent. Because if you want to completely redo one scene, or if you have to suddenly move, then it makes things easy on you later.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah, that's huge because when we had my basement waterproofed a couple years ago, the one thing that had to come down was the benchwork. But I basically had built them all in either 2x4 sections or 2x6 sections, and I was able to put them back up again within weeks.
That's smart. That's good.
See, you're a smart person. You should be the one who's giving all of these lessons, not me.
The thing is, Tim could probably give a lot of these, but, you know, you have to really sit down and think about it, you know?
Yeah, I just spent 40 minutes talking about how badly I failed.
Well, you know what, though? Seriously, you know, not to, you know, jump in the middle of it, but, I mean, that's how we learn. You know, one of the groups that I've talked about many times that I belong to is the Layout Design SIG. And John, are you a member at all? Or
no, I'm not, but I'm very familiar with them.
Good, good. Okay, you probably should at some point because it's a fascinating organization. But the point that I wanted to make on that, just real quick, is that their motto is "Make only new mistakes." So the idea is we all make mistakes, but the idea is we want to try to learn from each other so we don't have to keep making the same mistakes all over again.
So. Yes.
That's wonderful advice, Craig. Curse you for not giving that to me 5 years ago.
You're welcome. Go on, please. I'm sorry I interrupted.
It's okay. It's okay. Now to track work. Track work is almost as important as bench work. Avoid all track kinks, both vertical and lateral, like the plague.
Yeah.
Invest in ribbon rail track gauges, at least for your minimum radius. If you can, make radius guides out of foam core for every inch increment radii, from 2 inches below your lowest radius to 12 inches above your largest anticipated radius. So what I'm talking about here is to just buy a 2x3 foot a piece of foam core like you would for a poster board at a Michaels.
Sure.
And then to pin a ruler in one end of it and to draw out concentric arcs. And so then say you have an arc that is 21 inches on the inside and 22 inches on the outside. And then the next one is 22 inches on the inside and 23 inches on the outside and so on.
Sure, sure. Okay.
It actually makes a very wonderful looking piece of art when you stack them all together.
No doubt.
But it's also incredibly useful both when making a full-size track plan for your railroad room and for laying track itself. Also, save all ties that you cut away from flex track and then file them down to remove the spike detail and slide them back under the track joints and feeder gaps.
That is
excellent. This will make your layout look a lot better, and it's just a very simple thing that you can do to hide the joints between pieces of track.
Yep, absolutely. I do that myself.
I thought you hand laid everything, Craig.
Well, not everything. But.
I see. Anyway, now on to electrical issues that might arise.
Oh, I know all about this.
Oh.
Just call me Sparky.
All right. Now, let's see. The first piece of advice I have here is do not let the blue smoke out of your decoder boxes.
Oh, well, there you go. Thank you very much, Cleveland. Good night. That was...
It's worth the price of admission right there.
All right. Use DCC-friendly turnouts whenever you can. It's okay to use the unfriendly ones, but DCC-friendly always make things better. Be careful when ballasting track. Try not to let any matte medium or ballast get above the level of the ties so that you don't dirty the rails like I did. Put a feeder on every piece of non-turnout track. Do not rely on rail joiners to carry electrical current unless you have soldered them together.
Okay.
In turnout ladders, make sure that you drop feeder-attached rail joiners whenever you can to help the continuity of the electrical feed across the many joints in the ladder.
Okay.
And that's just as simple as taking a rail joiner, turning it over, and soldering a wire onto it.
Sure.
Always attach feeders to the underside of the rail whenever you can. It's very easy to do, and obnoxious in today's modeling standards to do anything otherwise, because...
All right, I'll stop doing it then.
Well, I'm guilty of that one, too, so...
Oh, boy. Never mind, I would like to not say that it is obnoxious.
You know what I'll say about that, John, is that a little bit of paint goes a long way.
Touche, touche. But it's also a fairly easy thing to do, to just flip the piece of flex track over, cut out one tie with an X-Acto knife, and then put the feeder wire right there.
You see, you say that, but when you really get down to it, it's not that simple.
Eh, you're right. I guess that one could go both ways, depending on...
You know what? I'll say this. I think you're absolutely on point, and that is a great idea, but a lot of us are too damn lazy. And
what I did was, when I got a new order of FlexTrack in, I just set aside an hour for an evening to be a feeder attachment day. And I did them all in one go and got it out of the way as quickly as I could.
How very OCD.
Now that's...
Yeah. Exactly, Craig. I actually am OCD, and so that's insightful.
Well, there you are. Ask me how I know.
And now for a mantra that I have written up and pasted all over my layout room that I have tried to adhere to as best as I can for the new layout. Power all turnouts, turntables, and frogs. This refers to the turnout mechanisms, as in like actuating, going one route to another. The turntables, of course, being to turn them around, no hand-operated turntables, and then frogs to avoid the electrical cutouts for the short wheelbase locomotives like I referred to earlier. This is all mostly a bit more of a luxury and aesthetic, but I can say, having had both extremes back-to-back in terms of layouts, it does a lot if you power all turnouts, turntables, and frogs to make your railroad feel a lot more well put together and cohesive and functional for the operator.
Fair enough.
Caboose industry ground throws in most situations don't cut it. I use those primarily on the last layout, and I wasn't necessarily very happy with them.
Okay.
Ah, grades. Unlike me, do not go above a 3.5 to 4% grade. Track height, I promise you, is not worth it. What you can do is you can play with the scenery around it to make it look like it's in a more mountainous terrain. It is a lot better to do something like that and to try to trick the viewer than to do something that could risk the operational functionality of the layout.
Okay. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
Using plywood sub-roadbed is really helpful, especially by reinforcing the joints between the plywood, because that's an excellent way to get rid of vertical kinks. Because if anybody who's worked with a plywood sub-roadbed knows, if you pull up on any given area of the plywood in order to fix one of the grades, it doesn't create a kink. The whole piece of plywood gradually bends in order to make it as smooth a transition as possible. Mm-hmm. And so this will really help with avoiding bad vertical kinks.
Okay, yep, that's nice, true. Nice. It will.
Also, whenever you can, try not to place a turnout at the top or bottom of a grade unless the grade transition itself is smooth.
Those are excellent points, yes. I haven't done that, but I have seen it done, and you're not wrong.
Yeah, that was one of the problems that I had. I had a turnout that was at the kink that went up on both sides.
Oh,
and
boy.
It was really unnerving to see 4 of the 8 driver wheels of a locomotive just lifting in midair as it went from the top to the back.
Yeah, I can see where that would be a bit of a pucker moment.
You know, I'm going to go back real quick. Yeah, because I do agree with the grades, although I've seen one guy who's – and I believe it's 4%, might be – who's done it well, because most of the time I agree, yeah, please don't do it. But Ralph de Blasi has, I believe it's at least 4% on his one hill. But again, he usually makes sure that there's about 4 or 5, sometimes even 6 diesel units pulling that train. He's modeling in the Lehigh Valley area. That grade is – a heck of a grade. And of course, Craig, as you know, Ralph weights his
cars. Oh yeah, he weights them pretty heavy too, well above the NMRA standard.
Yeah, so man, do those engines have to work for every?
This
every
is where going back to what John was talking about, letting the blue smoke out.
Yes.
Well,
I don't think he's done that yet, but wow, they are.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah, well, if it's 4% and not 22%, I guess it's good.
Yeah, 22% might be a little extreme.
Yeah, you missed that, Craig.
Obviously.
It was actually a grade. So I was on my old layout, I used the Woodland Scenics foam risers.
Sure, yeah.
I used the 4% foam risers. I did a miscalculation, but I still wanted the track to go up really high, so I took one of the foam risers and I squished it so that it was shorter.
Oh.
When I was writing the script, I went back and measured the grade, and it was 22%.
Holy moly.
I know.
That's impressive.
You really squished it.
Did anything actually make it up?
I think the Bachmann Climax did with roughed up rails because it was slipping pretty badly before. But
a geared locomotive would be about the only thing that would really have a chance.
Yeah, you're right.
Oh, man.
Well, that's impressive.
I wouldn't necessarily call it impressive. I think a more negative adjective is requisite.
Trying to be nice.
Anyway, what a detour. To yards and staging.
Always
have staging, no matter what, whenever you can. It's extremely useful. It will make your life a lot easier. And also, whenever you can, put a yard on the layout, even if it's a small one. Because, again, yards can be useful for non-operational purposes as well.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah.
Also, an important one, in the staging yards, try, if you can, put an extra track for car storage or varying non-revenue cars. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you have a tourist train that's never going to see the light of day in operating session, or if you have, like, the Minuteman Scale Model's iCar, instead of needing to take those on and off the layout every single time, you can take your favorite cars and just leave them on a track or two in the back of the staging yard for storage.
Sure, mm-hmm. Okay.
That's something that I discovered was actually surprisingly useful when I had a staging yard.
Oh, no, it's good. That's good. Well, look, I mean, you know, you're not going to get an argument from me that staging isn't a good thing, because staging is cool. It's, I mean, staging, you know, gives you the option to model the rest of the world aside from what you're actually modeling. So, you know, and it gives you a place to have your trains come from and go to. So, I mean, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that at all. I think that staging is one of the best things to happen to model railroading in the last 30 years. So, you're not wrong.
Hey, Craig, as to the best of your recollection, who do you think was the first guy who really brought about the concept of staging?
That's a good question. I believe that – I know that Alan McClelland was one of the first people to really write about it, but it might actually have been some of the earlier guys who did that. I don't think that John Allen had staging. But I'm certain that Alan McClelland did. He was certainly the first one, I think, who really popularized it. It certainly started catching on after he started talking about it. Alan McClelland was really a major, you know, trendsetter back in the day, and really came up with a lot of amazing concepts. The staging was definitely – if he wasn't the one that developed it, he certainly was the person who popularized it.
Gotcha. All right. Very good. I was just curious, so thank you.
Sure.
All right, John, you're going to talk to us – your structures is the next point you're going to pick up and what you have learned.
Exactly. Whenever you can, weather your structures. Don't be afraid to start. It's just as simple as getting some very cheap weathering powders or some of your wife's makeup and then putting it all over the building. You don't have to do well. Pretty much anything looks good. So in short, just weather them whenever you can. Yep. But also, always have a bottle of diluted India ink for weathering purposes. I put off buying India ink, I don't know why, for a very long time, and I tried to make do with diluted black paint. It just honestly never worked well.
Yeah, it's not the same. It's really not. And John's absolutely right. I just went through this myself recently. I've had a bottle of ink, diluted ink, for the longest time. And every now and then I'll pull it out and I'll start using it. I'm like, oh my God, this is great. It's just amazing. And then, you know, I'll be like all gung-ho and I'll use it for a couple of weeks. And then the bottle gets put away and I forget about it. And I'll pull it out again a year later. And I'll be like, try that. And they're like, oh, this is great. So, yeah, I totally agree. It's one of the greatest things you can use for structures, for freight cars. It's an amazing thing because it sucks into all the little cracks and stuff and gives everything definition. It puts shadow lines in. It's if there's, like John is saying, if there's one thing you do, diluted ANI is one of the greatest things, if nothing else, just to start with, because it'll put a slightly, you know, a weathered look on anything. And from there you can build. But that's a great place to start.
Another good thing is to have a layout scrapbook. I don't remember where I picked this up from, but it was very recently that I came up with the idea, or that I found the idea and started using it. What you should do is you should have a big three-ring binder with a bunch of a document protector sheets in it. And then every single article in every magazine or book that you have that details how to do a project that you want to do, you should photocopy the pages and then slip them into the document protectors so that this three-ring binder becomes a kind of a guide of all of the things that you want to do and how to do them. So you can use them kind of as a repository for simple reminders, not necessarily projects. You could use them for detailed explanations of how to do in-depth projects that you haven't done yet or are scared to do. You can use it as a source of inspiration by copying track plans and pictures of noteworthy model railroads and putting it in there as well. And then finally, I use it also as a repository for all of the paper prototype information that I have. So it's a very versatile idea that helps me to reconvene and get where I need to go in terms of model railroading
That's really good. I mean, I've done the same thing with I have more than a couple of three-ring binders running around in my office and also downstairs on the railroad. And another thing that I've taken to doing in the last couple of years, just because I happen to have it handy, is I have a scanner that I keep next to my computer here in the office. And when I come across a article like Model Railroader or something like that, or I'll just bring it upstairs and I'll scan it, and I have a directory on my computer on the hard drive where I just go and I drop all these scanned items in, so it doesn't take up any space and it's available to me at any time just to pop on the computer and you know, poke through it. Nice. But I also love the idea, John, and it's one thing that I've been a little remiss about doing is for my own railroad, one of the things that you're talking about is, as you said, keeping a scrapbook for, you know, writing down important information like where did you put the block separators on the railroad so you know where one power district starts and the next one ends. Or another thing that I've tried to do, and I haven't been as successful with as I'd like, but writing down formulas for painting freight cars. You know, like if I painted a freight car and I want to be able to do that again at some point, you know, what paints did I use? What was the mixture? You know, how did I do those things? And those are great things to have jotted down. Whether it's in a binder or in a note in the computer or on your phone or something like that, you know, someplace you can find that stuff. But I don't think any of us really do that, you know, or maybe some of us do, but most of us don't do that to the degree that we really should. And I think it would be really helpful, like you're saying, for more people to do that.
Mm-hmm. I guess then that means I've stumbled on something.
By Jove, I think you have.
Probably the best thing, I completely agree with you, Craig, but probably the best thing that I would like to add to that is from the original place where I found this. I really should have done the research to figure out where it was. But the best thing to do is to make it a living resource. As in, when you're done with projects, you take the documents out again. Because if it's just a repository of every single interesting idea that you find, then it's going to get bogged down in miscellany and volume very quickly. But if you
keep
all the stuff that you want to do and then you get rid of it once you're done with it, then it becomes a much more relevant and immediate resource to what you're doing on the railroad.
Nice.
Okay, that makes sense, yep. The other things that you could do with that also is, if you don't want to necessarily lose things, is if you have a a current binder, and you move things in and out of that so that anytime you're doing something, you just go to that binder, which always has your current project, things you want to work on right away. And if you finish something or put something on the back shelf, you can move it to a different binder. But that's probably way more organized than most of us ever want to be.
Yeah, something like that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And now on to the miscellaneous recommendations that really didn't have much of another place to be put. I highly recommend using your NMRA gauge and your coupler height gauge to assess bad ordered cars. If they pass and they still derail, please scrutinize the track. Learn from my mistakes.
Yeah, you're not the only one. Go on.
Also, make as many runarounds as possible flat so that you have the option to use them for switching, even if that's not for their intended use.
Oh, yes.
Yep, but thank
we
you. All know that one.
Yeah, my one and only runaround on the previous layout was on a hill.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's, again, you know, not to, there's ways to get around that. You can put weeds in, you know, between the ties that, you know, stick up enough to kind of hold the axles in place without, you know, having them be so stiff that it derails the cars. But, you know, generally you're right. But that said, there's ways around that.
There are ways around it, but it's really a big bog down for the main source of operations on the model.
Yeah, well, if it's the main one, then yeah, you might be right.
Yeah. Also, and I've learned this in building my current layout right now, three-way turnouts and most especially curved turnouts are well worth the extra price.
Okay.
I cannot recommend that enough, especially for people dealing with a small layout in a small space.
See, me and Craig just build our own.
Wonderful. Well, see, that's what I was going to say. I didn't want to, you know, rain on his parade or anything. You know. But yeah, I just make the damn thing myself.
But it's true. Some people are definitely in I hear what you're saying, though, John. Yeah. If you're looking to save space and, you know, that's why the rear railroad uses three-way turnouts and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And of course, I mean, you know, Tim and I are being flippant, but, you know, yeah, I mean, track work is, you know, not the easiest thing in the world. You know, it's not the hardest thing in the world, certainly, but Tim and I both know how intimidating it can be, you know, and if you want to use prefab track, you know, it works. I mean, use it. It does cost a fair bit, you know, especially for the specialized turnouts, but, you know, not everybody wants to, you know, whip out the rail and spikes and do it themselves. And I understand that. So yeah, if that works for you, then go ahead, you know, use it. Absolutely.
I all of a sudden feel so alone when I realize that I'm the only person in the chat room that does not hand lay track.
That used to be me,
we
John.
We can fix that, John. I got Tim. We can fix that.
Yeah, I've come up with a plan now. I'm going to, as quickly as I can, finish all of the track on the layout so that it's done before you guys get me as a handle.
You'll rip it up and replace it.
Yeah, and isn't that exactly it, Tim? Once he does that, he'll go like, oh, I can do better.
I ripped up an entire yard for
I know.
And I don't regret it.
It's a very dangerous thing, but it's also very rewarding.
I'm going to have to rethink my partnership with the Model Rail Cast.
You know, you might at that. Very insidious that way. Good idea.
I'm going to be the next convert. All right. All right. Sorry.
Nope.
All right. Next, you should also build a continuous running connection or a loop-to-loop design on your layout, even if you have no intention of running a train in circles, and even if you are the strictest of prototype modelers. I can promise you that someday you will lose it. Whoa. Excuse me. I can promise you that someday you will use it, and that you will find at least one point in your life when you're walking around the layout room and you just want to set a train on autopilot, and you want to walk around and do other things, and you don't want to have to man the train turning it at other ends. Sometimes you can't do it, you're in a small layout or a switching layout, but even if it's on a fold-down leaf, my point is, whenever you can, it's worth it to have a continuous running option. Mm.
That's interesting, and you know, it's funny because you guys may have seen it. It came up on Facebook a couple of days ago about return loops, and you know, because some people say, "Oh, that's unprototypical." You know, the railroad doesn't have that. And then, like before the day was even over, we had like a dozen examples of loops on the actual prototype. I believe at least three of them here in South Jersey. So. Anyhow, please continue.
Yep, that's true. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, I'm going to reserve judgment. I don't necessarily agree with that. But, you know, at the same time, I'm talking about a different type of layout design. In that case, you know, for operations and all. So, you know, the circumstances are different. Yeah. So, you know, but it's, you know, John's not wrong. It doesn't work for everybody in every situation. But, you know, you've got a point.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. And now you have code 70 rail.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's probably the one good thing that I did on the previous layout was to use the code 70 rail. A lot of people are worried that if you use smaller rail sizes that it's going to be more finicky. Actually, when the code 70 rail is used properly, it actually works out to be very, very smooth running.
Oh, apparently not that smooth. Wow.
Yeah, oops, sorry.
Oh, the bullshit detector went off.
Sorry.
That's okay. That was pretty funny.
That'll make it to the bleeper reel.
Oh, no doubt.
The bleeper reel is, at this point, is probably going to be longer than the episode.
Awesome.
Anyway, a lot of people worry that if you use the smaller rail sizes, it's going to be more finicky. And at least when you use it properly, it not only runs very, very well, but it looks fantastic. Nothing destroys an image of a layout for me than something with than a picture of it with a big honking code 100 rail. It just looks so unprototypical and disgusting. But code 70 rail, even though it's by modeling standards NHO scale, even though it's really tiny and there aren't that many products for it, it looks so good that it's well worth the extra effort put into it.
Yep, well, that's true. I used code 70 on my railroad, and I'm very happy with it. Can't argue with that.
Now, when it comes, though, to buying those three-way turnouts, how hard is that for code 70?
Ah, see, now that's a good question.
I have found enough of everything in code 70.
Okay.
You can get number 4 turnouts, number 6 turnouts, three-way, and then curved turnouts in both directions.
Okay.
However, uh-oh. Shinohara, for some reason, dropped off the face of the earth for about 9 months, and none of those things were in production. So even though they existed, the only place to get them was on peer-to-peer websites like eBay or in online retailers that had very deep stock rooms.
Gotcha.
So ignoring that one little hiccup, they seem to be back online.
Well, there was this whole Fukushima thing, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
True.
Not saying that had anything to do with it, but, you know.
Should take that into account.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But honestly, in code 70 anyway, code 75, you're going to have a nightmare. But code 70, there's enough to get by pretty decently in terms of prefabbed turnouts.
That's cool.
And I will say this, code 83 and code 100, I tend to agree with John that they definitely appear a little oversized. But like I said a little while ago about the rail, the track feeders, you know, a little paint goes a long way. And if you, you know, if you code 100 track and you paint it and ballast it well and everything like that, you can really get away with a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The problem is
code
you
83.
Don't.
Yeah. When it's very shiny and it's evident that the rail is there,
that's
then it distracts.
Yeah. You got to paint it.
Yeah.
You know?
But
I've seen some amazing railroads that all use code 100. And it's, you know, after, you know, you might notice it here and there, but, you know, if it's painted well and handled, and you don't even notice it.
But the nice thing is that, like, with the code 70, half the work is already done, in a sense, just because of the size, appearance.
Well, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I use code 100, but that's basically, well, there was two reasons. I had a lot of surplus, but the other is because the PRSL was an extension of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Not only did they use heavy rail on the main lines, but they actually, especially in Pavonia, used heavy rail there, too.
Okay.
But
so if it's prototypical, of course, that's fine.
But that's the exception. That's not the rule, so. It it was handy for me, but, you know, if you're modeling, well, especially, I mean, gosh, well, code 100 rail for Craig's layout would be like insanity.
Well, that would be insane. Yeah.
I have him beat. Even though he is modeling railroads in the pre-1900s, he at least was still modeling a big railroad. I'm modeling a railroad that was so small and so poor that the track was so badly out of gauge, sometimes the entire train would slide between the rails and they would have to slot car the locomotive all the way to the finish.
Well, then, I wouldn't worry so much about your track.
There you go. Yeah. Nice.
Anyway. But I guess
see, now if you had battery powered locomotives, you could model.
Yeah, that's true. That is the best argument for dead rail I've ever heard.
Don't you think?
Dead rail? Who needs rails? Much less electricity.
Yeah. Yeah, go full Doc Brown on it. We don't need roads, you know.
I'm modeling a steam tractor.
There you go.
I love those things.
I guess my point with this Code 70 discussion is when you're first starting out, when you're building any sort of model railroad that's not strictly prototype-based, if you're choosing between Code 100 and Code 83, pick Code 83. If you're a little bit more experienced and you want a really good-looking railroad, you might want to consider Code 70, at least for some areas on the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Very good.
Yeah, and I'll mention one thing just in at the end of that discussion, and that's that I heard that very recently Microengineering has just redone a lot of the molds for a lot of the products. I think the Code 55 FlexTrack, Code 70 FlexTrack, and some other things. They were somewhat unavailable for some time, like John was saying, really only from eBay and other places like that. But apparently they've just redone a lot of those molds, and those products are going to become much more available very soon. So that's a definite plus.
Oh, very cool.
When you're looking at the better looking track, because there's a difference between, Model Power track and Atlas track and Microengineering track. Some of them look a lot better than others. Generally, they're all pretty much engaged. But if you're really a track as a model kind of person, then you really can't do a whole lot better than going with Microengineering, because it's really the best looking one that there is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more expensive, which, and I understand that that's why a lot of people don't use it, but it's, especially if you're talking like what John is saying with a smaller railroad where the investment isn't going to be that much, it's definitely worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. There.
Isn't it wonderful that they did all of the retooling only after I purchased all of the turnouts required?
But naturally, that's the way things go.
And then finally, the very last suggestion that I have that, in my opinion, applies to everybody. Whenever you finish running trains on the layout, be it an op session or you're just moving things around, you should always make up an excursion train and place it in a logical place, like in a staging yard, in a yard, or in front of a main station, or anywhere else that you can, because this expedites showing off your layout to other people who have dropped by without your notice.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is something that I cannot recommend enough to people, because I've had the opportunity to experience the benefits of this both on my own small layout at home and on a big club layout. If you just have a train ready and made up waiting for visitors right there, all you have to do in order to show the layout off to them is turn on the layout and turn on the throttle, especially if it's an excursion train, because that's something that catches people's attention and eyes much more so than a regular freight train. Mm. And it's not as if it takes too much work, but it's something that everybody can do to make things better for themselves, to make their layout look better, and to make the hobby look better as a whole.
Yeah, I like that, because I've had many visitors over, even people, if they're not into trains per se, if they know you're doing a model railroad, a lot of times they'll want to see it. And that's great if you can have just something you can run right away. And I think one other reason why I could definitely see you making that recommendation too is if you have one that's just for excursion, it's not like you're ruining or you're making extra work for yourself. If you're in the middle of an op session or between op sessions, you can leave the layout as it was staged already, and you don't have to worry about interfering with that. So,
yeah, this is kind of where the long-term storage tracks and staging that I brought up earlier come in.
Yeah.
Because you can just shunt the excursion train off to the side and keep it there without needing to worry about having one less staging track for regular operations, or without worrying about where you're going to put it when you do have an operation session.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah, very good. All right, well, we're going to reconvene Model Railcasters with John, but before I let him go, and John, I don't want to steal any thunder out of part two. If this was addressed further on, and I did read through the script, but I can't remember. But John, you're one of the prime examples of why I have been trying to reassure people that the hobby is not by a long shot dying. It's not even close to dying. And you're not a 55-year-old getting into the hobby, are you?
Absolutely wrong, Tim. I actually am a 55-year-old with a really high-pitched voice.
It just looks really good for 55.
But you're not finding that the case as a 20-year-old.
Not in the slightest. I actually, as we'll get to in the next episode, I have a project going with another friend of mine who's also under 25.
Yeah, very good. Very good. And now, have you been able to make it to a lot of I know you saw Craig at a show, and have you been able to make it to any shows out there? Is your schedule allowing for that?
Not since that time, though I am currently a more active member in the local Model Railroad Club. I use the term local. It's actually 40 miles away, but I am a member in that, and that is taking up a lot of my time. It's also kind of like we're in a little bit of a dead space here in the Pacific Northwest. There are only a few shows a year.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
So,
anyway, John, yes. What's the club that you belong to,
The Swamp Creek and Western Model Railroad Club, sitting inside the former freight house of Edmonds Station, Washington, right on the route of the Empire Builder.
Interesting.
Yeah, very cool. Okay.
So once a week, every evening, I am tempted to illegally board an Amtrak train and escape my life.
Well, that's nice.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Now, are you part of the NMRA, John, or
just out of curiosity? I know that I was. I actually think that I am right now, although I have to check up on that subscription, I have to check up on that membership, because I believe that I only purchased a temporary membership for the NMRA convention in Portland, and now that I actually am definitely back in the hobby, I do want to join up with them again.
Great, great.
It's a good choice.
Yeah, very good, very good. All right. Well, Craig, do you have anything for us that you want?
No, not really. I'm sorry I wasn't able to make it in for the earlier part.
Sorry I had to go on.
No, hey, you got to do what you got to do, you know? I mean, not a problem there. But I just wanted to say that we mentioned a moment ago that, you know, I met John this past year back in 2015 at the National Convention out in Portland. And I had just gotten done doing a clinic, and he came up to me, and for the life of me, he said, "Do you know who I am?" And I'm like, you know, the voice sounds a little familiar, but no, I'm sorry, I don't. And, you know, he said, "I'm John." And I'm like, no way. And it was just so nice to see him. And, you know, he had some really lovely things to say, which really touched me. And thank you again, John, for that. I really appreciate it. And to know that you're going on, and I know we haven't talked about your project yet, and I know we will shortly, but I think it's just great, you know, what you're doing, and the fact that that we had some influence on helping you go in that direction, and that you found, you know, the things that Tim and I and Ryan all, you know, found that helpful to you. I think it's just one of the greatest things that in the process of doing this podcast, I've had the honor to feel and to learn and to know that, you know, we helped you out and made you feel, you know, happy and comfortable. And, you know, that really means a lot.
Yeah, I truly cannot thank you guys for all of the influence and guidance that you had on my modeling career. Let's be honest, you guys are the only reason I'm here today. You and the Model Railcast Show, and Ryan, bless his heart.
Yep. I mean, it didn't stop us from you making horrible mistakes on three of the layouts, but hey, you know. But we do the best we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, before I let you go, I'm
slacking there, but
John, before I let you go, I know we're going to talk about it more the next time we speak, but I do want to turn people on to the podcast that you put out. What is the information on that for our listeners?
Well,
where can they find that?
Sorry. Well, you are probably listening to this in iTunes right now, so I want you to open up your phone. Yes, you haven't opened up your phone yet. I'm waiting for you to do that. All right. Thank you for opening up your phone. Go to iTunes and open up the search bar and search Beginner's Guide to Model Railroading. It is my latest, greatest, and only podcast thus far, and I hope you enjoy it.
Excellent. And for the non, you know, we actually do. Craig's not the only one. I got a few non-iTunes users like Tony Ryan. Is there? Do you have a website yet where they could go to get the file, or is
not
that something
website,
you're working
on? I do not have a website yet, but it is available on SoundCloud, which is okay. Totally free.
Excellent.
All right. Not Apple.
Yes, we. You know what? Model railroading brings all sorts together, and so.
It's true.
If you can get an atheist and a believer, or a Mac user and a PC user in the same room, and they just want to play with trains, then that shows you how great the hobby is.
You're doing something right.
John, thank you for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me, Craig.
Yeah, absolutely. And Craig, thanks for coming on with us anyway. We know you had a late night, but I appreciate you joining up with us this evening.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And, of course, what we open the show with, we close the show with. The Model Railcast theme. Till next time, guys.
You've been listening to The Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS. And look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there. The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast. And drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.